ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that on one's 250th birthday, there should be a celebration. I'm Claire Nichols, and on The Book Show, we're raising our teacups to Jane Austen.
Why Austen? What is it about her?
Authors Colm Tobin, Karen Joy Fowler, and more will explore why, in 2025, the Austen effect is bigger than ever.
It's quite incredible.
Search for The Book Show and look for Dear Jane wherever you get your podcasts, or hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
Can there be any doubt that the Prime Minister really cares for Australian science?
My government will always champion Australian science. It matters. We know Australian science is a key driver of our economy now and will continue to be. Whether it's harnessing the power of AI, generating and storing renewable energy, improving the way we grow our food or treat illness, or quantum computing. Looking at the next few decades, it is Australian science that has so much to contribute to the world that we know is just around the corner.
The Science Show is not about the future of CSIRO, but we shall meet three young Australian scientists showing how very much their work, and hundreds like them, does such a huge amount for the nation's finer future. And later on we'll hear from the President of the Australian Academy of Science, Professor Chunapati Jagadish, about why Australian science may be broken. And then we go into space with Jonathan Webb. Hello, I'm Robin Williams, and our first young scientist is someone who looks after the landscape. She's a superstar of STEM.
Nicola Lowe, manager of the land development team at Colliers Engineering and Design.
Which is where?
We're based in Rhodes.
Where is that?
Slightly east of the geographical centre of Sydney, on the Parramatta River. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful location where a lot of our clients exist and a central base to a lot of our sites.
Are you qualified as an engineer?
I'm qualified as an environmental engineer.
What is the environmental part of it?
At the moment, I'm doing project management. So where I draw upon my environmental expertise is with contaminated lands, because that's where I started in the past.
Contaminated with what?
Asbestos and PFAS.
PFAS, right, yes. Is it really an eternal chemical?
It is. It doesn't break down. It's very hard to break the chemical chains, apparently.
Are they still using it for fighting fires?
No, there's been a ban on that, but it is still ever present in our environment, and they use it on fry pan for the non-stick coating.
So are you cooking the PFAS into your dinner as well?
We are, unfortunately. So if you have a fry pan that is peeling, I suggest you throw it out.
But they're all peeling.
Stainless steel. Stainless steel or stoneware.
Okay. Surely that sort of contamination throughout the land, where does it stop? Because you've got the entire landscape to deal with.
That's correct. And in my role, that's where we're trying to unlock a lot of these sites that do have asbestos or PFAS contamination on it, because they're the only sites left in Sydney that could be developed for future housing. And as you're aware, in Sydney, we have a shortage of housing. We have a housing crisis coming up.
And the story goes around Australia too, doesn't it?
That's right. Primarily around Sydney. That's my focus.
How many women do you have in your outfit?
We only have a small percent. It would be less than 10% in our company.
Do you need more women like that?
We do need more women in engineering, and I would strongly encourage them to come into the workforce and see what it's all about.
Aren't they coming anyway?
No. Unfortunately, we find that in high schools, a lot of the females say that they can't do science or maths, and they get scared away from the STEM subjects. And therefore engineering, we don't have that same sort of...
Still, I thought that had been solved.
I thought it had been solved 20 years ago, but unfortunately not. We're still here trying to encourage the girls to come in.
How come your interest is also in aspects of breast cancer?
I have been impacted by breast cancer in this past year as well. So as part of my journey, I have signed up to this program to make people more aware of breast cancer, also make people aware that it's associated with science, engineering, and that you can still be everything you want to be. You can still go out, manage, move up the corporate ladder, still be a mum, and keep active as well.
That's very interesting, because there have been huge campaigns. Need I mention the Pink Day at the Sydney Cricket Ground and so on? I would have thought that has gone so big that there'd be good follow-up, especially, and the whole point is, because it takes a long time, either in environment or in medicine, to train young people coming up and taking their position. Haven't they come in sufficient numbers?
The McGrath Foundation have done very well. It used to be just breast cancer nurses, but they've actually expanded their scheme now to include all cancers. So we are definitely making improvements and headroads into treatment of cancers and getting it out to the public.
And when you said this program, finally, you're talking about being superstar of STEM?
Correct. Yes, it's been a very exciting journey meeting 60 other women and non-binary people who are also excited about sharing their journey in STEM with the younger generation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Nicola Lowe, superstar of STEM, offering Australia a cleaner landscape. Another superstar of STEM, also organised by the Australian Science Media Centre for a day training at the SBS studios, has two other locations and another commitment for a finer future.
My name's Rebecca Duncan, and I'm a polar marine biologist at Linnaeus University in Sweden and the University of Technology in Sydney.
That's a long way apart, aren't they?
Yeah, yes. I've been working between the Arctic and Australia for about 10 years now. So
not the Antarctic?
No, the Antarctic.
It's closer, you know.
It's a lot closer, but it's harder to do research down there, that's for sure. There's a lot going on in the Arctic that is worth our attention.
Do you go to polar regions yourself?
Yes, so I just got back from North Greenland a week ago. I was on an icebreaker for 2.5 months in the north of Greenland, and I go to the Arctic every year to do field work for a good couple of months.
And what do you look for?
So me personally, I am looking at the sea ice algae, because they are the little microalgae phytoplankton that form the base of the food webs in the polar oceans. So my research is all about how they're changing with climate change, because that will impact energy supply to the whole marine food web.
Oh, but you're not looking at ways which you can alleviate the problem of the ice melting?
Not me specifically, although lots of wonderful scientists are, thank goodness. But yeah, I'm looking at how the ice melting is going to impact our oceans and the energy supply in our oceans. Yeah.
Before we get to that, I want to lob you two ideas. One of them, happening in Cambridge, actually with someone from Australia, is to make the clouds more reflective by having tiny bits of ice up there. Mm-hmm. And similarly, a way in which you can make the ice thicker by other means. Do you think that sort of geoengineering has a future?
It's not my area of expertise, so it's difficult to say, but I am not personally attracted to those ideas. I feel like they are a little bit of a wish and a prayer, and I think, you know, we could really solve these problems with some more conventional solutions and make a better effort to look after our planet rather than trying to come up with these crazy big ideas. But I mean, I guess the thing with sea ice and trying to create better and bigger sea ice, it's a huge expansive area. Like 10% of our oceans are frozen. So the idea that we could have such a large impact with these geoengineered solutions, I find difficult to believe. I think it would be better to just try and slow down the warming.
Yes, but that may take some time. We might not have enough time. That's the problem.
No, that's very true. And sometimes I do sometimes feel like a historian in my work rather than a scientist, in that documenting what we have and these important, vitally important frozen ecosystems.
A reporter, because you're a superstar of STEM, what are your colleagues, when you go on location and on those ships for 2.5 months, talking about the possibility of geoengineering? Are most of them rather like you, doubtful or what?
Yeah, I think most people, when we talk about these sorts of things, are fairly doubtful. We've had big ideas like this before in terms of, they were talking about iron fertilisation in the ocean. Yeah, I don't think those ideas are particularly attractive to us as scientists.
Iron fertilisation, in other words, that makes the various life forms grow faster when you put the powdered, if you like, iron in.
Yeah, and I think with things like that, it's always the flow-on effects that we aren't fully aware of or understand. And I think that's where it gets a little bit dangerous. It always reminds me of the whole cane toad problem. Like, we try and solve one problem with this big idea that actually has more detriment than positive in the end. So yeah, and I think that's where we got to with the iron fertilization topic, was that it actually could cause more harm than good, and then it's too big and too late to actually come back from. So I think with these really large scale ideas, it's a bit scary if we don't fully understand the repercussions of them.
Of course, when it comes to ice and the effect on the oceans and so on, we all are concerned about polar bears, but what about where you are looking at, in other words, the algae? How are they changing?
Well, the algae changing directly impact polar bears. So if you care about polar bears, you need to care about algae, because they actually get nearly 100% of their nutrition indirectly from the algae. But algae are changing in the sense that they rely on the sea ice as habitat. So they grow within the bottom of the sea ice. And if we don't have that sea ice, then we don't have that habitat for the algae. Then there's not that algae for the little krills and other zooplankton to eat, then there's not them for the fish to eat, and so on. So they're losing their habitat in the same way that polar bears are.
Indeed. Is it happening fast?
Extremely fast. So recent research has just come out to say that we will probably lose all of the summer sea ice in the Arctic by 2030. So this isn't a problem to kick down the road. This isn't a problem for our grandchildren. This is a problem for us in the next decade. And that includes the last ice area, which is where I just was a week ago. And that's the ice north of Greenland that we knew to be the last ice on the planet that will be there year round. And we now think from the high resolution modelling that that will be not there in summer in 2030. So this is a 5 to 10 year problem, not a 50 to 100 year problem.
Hence you're wanting to be a superstar of STEM, going out there to tell the world to get their act together.
Yeah, exactly. This is not something to think about in generations from now. This is a today problem. And it impacts everybody. I mean, you don't have to specifically care about the polar regions if you don't want to, but them melting and the sea ice melting directly impacts us in Australia, because it directly regulates our climate and all the climate stability all around the world. So when the sea ice melts, the world heats up, and no matter where you live, that directly impacts you. So everybody needs to care.
When are you going back to Sweden?
A couple of months. I'm never gone long. I usually am in the Arctic in April and May every year. That's when we get all the microalgae blooms. That's when we get 24-hour daylight, and that's when life is pumping in the Arctic. So that's an important time for us to be there. I'll be there in spring.
Well done. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, study algal growth and you help polar bears. As we showed last week, there are also many fields of science, such as geology and psychology, where the nation's needs are clear and obvious, but where support has crashed. That was Rebecca Duncan just now from Linnaeus University in Sweden, and also from the University of Technology in Sydney. So, from superstars of STEM to one of our ABC top five scientists this year, Amal Osma from Flinders University in Adelaide, who's using physiology to help apnea patients. Apnea, that ferocious snoring that can lead to breathing shutdowns, has increased with global warming. And Amal has opened all kinds of remedies.
Do you recall your dreams most nights?
No.
Do you snore?
I used to, but then I got a remedy. Now, I wanted to ask you about that remedy, because I wasn't inclined to go for the machine where you have air blown up your nose and so on. And so I went for what they call the two-pillow answer. Because if you can prop yourself up a little bit, strangely, this miracle happens.
That's right. So your posture can affect how collapsible your airway is. So this is your throat region. So simply avoiding sleeping on your back, so sleeping on your side, can either reduce snoring or cure sleep apnea for some people. And changing your posture and having an extra pillow could also help.
Well, it's because it saved time, and we had pillows in the house anyway.
Yes, so when you have sleep apnea, what can happen is the airway gets smaller and you're finding it harder to breathe. So you're putting in more effort to suck in harder and harder to try and open up your airway. And often your airway can also completely collapse. And so you might be moving, like your chest rises and falls a lot more than normal. And then when you are able to open up your airway, you take a big breath in and then you go back to sleep. And then your breathing events can happen frequently throughout your entire sleep duration. So this could be related to what you're describing.
Have you ever yourself used those machines, the breathing ones?
I've used it once for a research study, and it wasn't as bad as I imagined it to be.
How long did you have to use it? Overnight?
I used it for the entire night. And initially, when you're first new to it, you do find that your natural breathing changes because now you have pressurized air blowing in through your nose and you're trying to get used to a new breathing pattern. But once you settle into it, it's not too bad.
How's the sale going? Because I knew Peter Farrell from ResMed, and indeed there was the brilliant man who worked out the physiology and so on from the University of Sydney. Was it Sullivan?
Colin Sullivan, yes. He invented the CPAP machine over at University of Sydney.
Do you know him?
I've met him once and he's fantastic, yeah.
Just shows you one of the examples of research going on in a kind of blue sky way, basic research. Next thing, you have a way of investing in a company. And now ResMed is huge because it's also based in Southern California. Mm. And I've been there and I've been to Peter Farrell's mansion. Now his son is running the company. Peter Farrell, of course, an engineer. So this combination of a biological person and an engineer really worked.
Yeah. I couldn't tell you about how their sales is going, but I can tell you that it's a fantastic treatment for sleep apnea for people who are able to accept and tolerate CPAP. Almost transformative for improving breathing and sleeping well.
And what about the machines that go along with it? Some of them are misleading in some way. What is it?
The other treatments for sleep apnea. So if you're not able to tolerate CPAP, other options include a mouth guard, so a custom-made mouth guard, which pulls your lower jaw forward. It creates more space at the back of the throat and makes breathing easier. And it works for about half of people who try it. For people who it's successful for, it's as good as CPAP therapy. Other treatments for sleep apnea include weight loss. That can help for most of people, at least improving sleep apnea severity or treating it entirely. And of course, now we have medications to aid with weight loss, so it's more of an accessible treatment for more people. And then we have new treatments that are emerging, such as hypoglossal nerve stimulation. I'm not sure if you've heard of that one. It involves implanting a device that applies electrical stimulation to the nerve that controls the tongue muscle. And this is like a pacemaker, but for the airway, and it makes the tongue basically stick out and improves the airway. And this works for about a third of people who try it. So we're doing research to improve the existing treatments, but also to try and develop new treatments so that people with sleep apnea have more options and more opportunity to sleep well and not thrash about when they're trying to sleep.
Final two questions. What will you be doing next when you go further in your research?
So at the moment, I'm really interested in better understanding how pulse oximeters work in people who have dark skin. So there is evidence that there is an inaccuracy where the readings overestimate. And this means that for black patients, there's higher chance that these devices, which estimate oxygen levels, are presenting readings in the normal range when they're actually very, very low, which has implications in hospital for getting the right diagnosis and the right treatment. But in sleep apnea, we use these pulse oximeters all of the time. And we do not have any understanding at this stage on how it might impact sleep apnea diagnosis. So I'm leading a study trying to measure sleep apnea in people with dark skin and seeing if it's as accurate in other groups of people.
When I was quite small and my father was snoring and did so very loudly, and I asked him why, and he said, "Oh, we have to do that. Fathers have to do that in the jungle because they keep the wild animals away."
That's the first I've heard of it, but
there's no evidence.
There's no evidence, no. In fact, I'm in the business of stopping snoring. But don't tell your father I said that.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
The delightful ABC Top 5 scientist Amal Osmer from Flinders University in Adelaide. So just three young scientists, okay, high achievers, almost random examples of thousands at her university's CSIRO and industry who are saving lives, creating wealth and conserving nature, but whose careers, as we showed last week, can be tragically uncertain. Now meet Professor Chunapati Jagadish, who addressed this conundrum in Canberra a few days ago. How does this rich country continue to neglect its scientists despite the need and despite their talent? And his own story is a lesson. Why isn't Professor Jagadish just working like a peasant in India? As you were saying in the academy just now, talking about growing up and the importance of teachers, you were in a primary school in your village and you'd done quite well. Then what happened? How were you rescued?
So I finished my primary school and then my father wanted me to go to high school, but in my village there was no high school. He happened to mention this one to my maths teacher in a neighboring village, expressing his frustration but not being able to send me to high school. My maths teacher came forward and said, why don't you ask him to come and stay with us? So I lived with my maths teacher for 3 years in order to be able to finish my high school. Without the help of two of my math teachers in the high school, I will be plowing the fields in India today. So the teachers play an absolute critical role in not only inspiring kids in my case, really helped me to be able to finish high school, to be able to go for further studies.
And you went from high school to the university in India, and then you went abroad and got higher qualifications, and here you are, a retiring professor, the president of the Academy of Science. You're the president until, is it May?
Yeah, May 2026, I'll be completing my term and handing over the reins to the next president.
Who's an expert in epilepsy.
Yes, indeed. And Professor Sam Berkowitz from University of Melbourne is a neuroscientist and expert in epilepsy.
I was charmed to see you with the Minister, Tim Ayres, from the Science and Industry Ministry. I sometimes have to hesitate before I put the industry and the science together, because wouldn't it be good if we had a Minister for Science finito, okay, with connections informally to other parts? But every time I see, as with the predecessor, Ed Husic, pronouncements are on industry and very, very rarely about science.
The science, as you know, Robin, is really spreads a broad range of portfolios. Science covers not only industry, and Department of Education has got a significant proportion of the science research-related activities, and Department of Health has got a major research activity, for example, Department of Defense, Department of Agriculture. So really, science cross-portfolio activity. So we need to really have a coordinated effort across the government to make sure that the science is valued by the government, and then basically science and evidence-based decisions are made in policy-making as well.
At the Prime Minister's Science Prize, both the Prime Minister and, of course, the Minister said wonderful things about science, but you, a couple of days ago, gave a speech which had some severe criticisms of the state of science in Australia. What did you say at that speech?
So the main challenge for us, Robin, in our country is that there are a lot of supporters of science, but there are no champions. We need champions of science in the government, those who really value science, and then see science as a strategic national asset. Science is a power and influence to be able to play a key role in the global scene. So that is why science needs to be really valued as a strategic asset. And then if really science is seen as something worthwhile to do or otherwise luxury to do, that means that's not the right approach to think from that point of view. In these geopolitical circumstances where it is an enormous amount of global competition is taking place across the countries, science is really playing a key role, and we need to make use of science as a strategic national power.
So what does the government need to do? How do you need the support to make it work properly?
The government has really launched this strategic examination of the R&D and CERT, and we are waiting for the CERT to really come out with their report, which is at the moment looking at across the government what are the opportunities to enhance and use science effectively for the benefit of our nation. So that is why we are waiting for the CERT report. First and foremost, we'd like to see what are the recommendations of CERT, and then they also make sure that the government has got an implementation plan, put the appropriate resources to really empower science as a national asset.
But you have in the past, and I broadcast this, said that Australian science is broken. Did you not?
Yes, this problem is science being really carried out in different portfolios. And as I said that in the past, 14 portfolios, there are about 140 programs are there. One program doesn't know what the other is doing. That is why the Australian Academy of Science has championed for the call for a comprehensive review of the R&D sector and science sector. This third has been announced 18 months back or so. That is what we are waiting for, to see the outcome of that one. So that really can really provide us a strategic direction for the nation, how we can make use of science as strategic power and influence in the global sector.
Yes, Tim Ayres, the minister, seemed terribly friendly here in the Academy, which he'd never visited before. And he talked about the regular promptings that you get, his department gets from the Academy. And it seemed very much in goodwill. There was no kind of antagonism there. And I would thought that's a good basis for turning things round and really making it effective. Because you see, if young people are looking at Australian science and they see everyone struggling, that means they're not necessarily opting for a career in science and they're being put off. We want good news, not just bad.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, in the geopolitical situation and then also be able to address the climate change and net zero energy transition also, we as a nation need to have a strong STEM workforce. Mm. In fact, Australian Academy of Sciences recent report, which we launched in September, we looked at what are the national needs of science in 10 years' time by 2035. And so we call that as Australia's science, Australia's future. What are the capability gaps in terms of the skills and then also infrastructure and a range of things? And in that report, we have identified we'll be needing many more mathematicians than what we're able to produce now. And we'll be needing more data scientists. We'll be needing more material scientists. We'll be needing more geologists. So sometimes, you know, that's why it is very important that we make the public aware of it, and also school children and teachers are aware what are the skills we'll be needing to really move our economy from resource-based economy towards the knowledge-based economy, and also be able to address some of the climate change impacts or so. That means we really need to have an outstanding STEM workforce.
Yeah. You actually said that before we actually celebrate this selling of rare earths and minerals and such like, we need to have the scientifically qualified people who can actually handle that and recognize what's needed.
Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes, you know, parents and children may look at, for example, geology is for mining. But the problem is that we do need to have people with geology and earth science skills in order to be able to address these critical minerals, which are absolutely critical for net zero energy transition or so. So that is why I think there need to be an education in terms of ensuring that people have enhanced awareness of what are the skills we need. I also tell people basic sciences have an important role to play. Whatever the new technologies which are coming, we need to have people with the skills in mathematics, physics, chemistry, and biology. So thereby, we as a nation are well prepared for any new technologies that are coming up.
Be flexible, in other words, yeah, absolutely, yeah. And because of the low rate, 1.6% of GDP you're getting from Canberra for research across the board, you did suggest to the Academy that there is an appeal to private industry to take up the slack, because someone needs to do so, and they've got funds upon which they depend, really, for their future employees.
Absolutely. And in fact, if you go and look at what is happening in US and UK and other countries, so today the US private industry is investing quite significantly because they see the value in research. So that is why it is very important for our industry looks at research investment. Research is not a cost. Research is an investment for the future.
Yes, indeed. Has anyone answered your call yet?
Not yet. And then we are working towards that one. That is why the Academy proposed if the industry in Australia is not doing research, they need to be a levy of 0.25% or 0.5% of their revenue is paid into a levy, and then which can be put into a dedicated research fund, which can support basic research in all areas of science. Mm. Similar to the Medical Research Futures Fund, MRFF. And that, of course, if the industries are doing excellent research, they do not have to pay levy. But if they're not investing enough in the system, and then they need to start paying levy. And in fact, it's not something new, which we are already doing it in our country. For example, the farmers really pay a small amount of levy, which really enabled us to be able to create some things like a Grain Research Development Corporation, which really supports research in developing the new crops and the disease-resistant crops and the range of crops which we've been able to develop and enhance the productivity in agriculture. And we can be able to do that one in other industries as well. So that is why research should be seen as an investment. And let us hope that both the government and then the industry sector looks at this as an opportunity to really enhance our research capacity in our nation. It is very, very important. As you know, Robin, many countries, whether you talk about US or Europe, many European countries like Switzerland, Germany, and Sweden or so, they invest more than 3% of their GDP in R&D because they see that as the driver of the productivity of the nation, driver of the economy, driver of creation of new jobs and new technologies. So we need to really start changing that thinking from everything seen as a cost to an investment so that we can really enhance productivity in our nation and also enhance economic growth as well.
Going back to your own story, as we mentioned in the beginning, if there had not been for your maths teacher giving you accommodation during high school, you would have been working in the field, you said. And instead, you went along and you joined industry in a way by working on LEDs. In other words, those lights we've got all around our houses and indeed the traffic lights and so on. And I think 2 or 3 years ago, the LED people got the Nobel Prize. Why didn't you get the Nobel Prize as well?
Of course, Nobel Prizes, first and foremost, of course, the people, those who received the Nobel Prize are really the real pioneers, those who really started this particular work in a particular material system called gallium nitride material system. Because till that point, we had the red LEDs and green LEDs, but not the blue LEDs, which are efficient. You need to have all three primary colors of green, blue, red in order to be able to have this white color and a range of colors or so. So then because of the fact that the limitations of Nobel Prize is only given to three people, and so then, of course, many people miss out. I don't want to imagine or say that I deserve a Nobel Prize. I'm grateful to many recognitions which I've received over my years and my career. And then I'm really grateful and I'm also lucky that I've got a wonderful students and postdocs and collaborators I had the pleasure of working with. In fact, pleasure working with others has been the major reward for me. And any other recognitions are just a bonus.
Yes, just a bonus. But the reward for us is in every house in Australia, there is a product of the work that you pioneered with your colleagues. It's not just a theoretical thing. It's in our houses and in our factories.
Yeah, of course. The thing is, many technologies which we have been working on, we developed some lasers, for example, which are currently used in the optical fiber communication systems, which are backbone of internet. But again, many people contribute to this research, and that's why let's not focus on the rewards and recognitions. Let us focus on what difference we can make to the society, what type of technologies which can really we develop and using basic science so that that can improve the quality of life for our people and also be able to address the societal needs.
Congratulations and thank you.
Thank you very much, Robin. It's a pleasure talking to you.
President of the Australian Academy of Science, Professor Jagadish. And so finally in this science show on Radio National about the deep importance of scientific research, we rise with Jonathan Webb to the cosmic heights, which also demonstrate the almost unlimited value of what gets done if only we knew. Jonathan.
Behind the reception desk at Sydney's vast International Convention Centre, there's a small office with a coffee machine and no windows. This is where I find a team of people responsible for bringing thousands of space experts here to Gadigal country for just a few days. It's the International Astronautical Congress, or IAC, 2025. And this is only the IAC's fifth visit to the Southern Hemisphere in 75 years. Lisa Vitaris is the director.
It is the world's largest space conference and largely an academic conference. But at Space Industry Association of Australia, we wanted to make it more appropriate for businesses to ensure that they can get amazing partnership opportunities out of it.
What does it change to have the IAC here, do you think?
It's definitely highlighted the Australian space industry on a global scale. So for the last 2 years, we've been travelling the world to different space conferences, and we've noticed an incredible uptick in interest in the Australian space industry. 10% of the abstracts for IEC 2025 were from Australians, which is fantastic. So hopefully that leaves a legacy.
What do you think is the most surprising or important thing that Australians don't realise about the space sector?
That space is critical for everyday life. Obviously, there's GPS, so Google Maps, there's telecommunications, but even financial transactions are powered by space. Our mining industry uses space, agriculture industry, emergency services. It's absolutely critical for everyday life on Earth.
There are many dimensions to this conference. Heads of space agencies are having closed-door meetings. Researchers are presenting talks and posters. And businesses are showcasing their tech. On the far side of the centre, there's a cavernous, bustling exhibition hall. Parked in one corner is a very big, very expensive truck.
This is Australia's newest space facility. It rolled off the production line Thursday last week, and it's a B-double truck, which is two modules that are connected together, and it's a mobile mission operations centre.
This is Craig James. He's a principal research engineer at the CSIRO.
People that are controlling rocket launches, they're all housed inside, and we've given them plenty of room and lots of technology areas that they can use to support those rocket launches out in remote areas where rocket launches usually occur.
What's the point of having a facility like this that can move around?
Well, space technologies and space launches are really important to Australia, be able to have its own sovereign capabilities. And there are various rocket ranges around Australia that are starting to become developed, but they are necessarily in very remote regions. So to get out to those regions, though, you don't want to have to build a lot of big infrastructure in those areas, particularly for environmental, social and governance. And in order to set up and train people, you also want to have your facilities close by, but then take them out where you want to be able to use them. And this facility enables that to happen by being able to rapidly go out somewhere, set up at a moment's notice, and then take it all down again and leave without a trace.
When is it likely to get tested out?
So we've been partnering in with the iLaunch Consortium and their partners, Southern Launch, and it's actually on its way now down to South Australia for its first tests in the rocket ranges within a matter of weeks.
One of the other benefits of having a giant space truck and driving it around the country is getting attention along the way. Matt Richardson is the Director of Space Education Programs for the iLaunch Consortium.
It's a literal vehicle, but it's also a great vehicle for STEM outreach and education. So on its way to regional South Australia, for example, where it will support some of this fantastic capability development in our industry, it's going to go through a lot of remote and regional communities which are, you know, historically underserviced when it comes to STEM opportunities and opportunities for engagement with new technology and industries and that sort of thing. So we have the ability, which is probably quite unique, to take something that looks like a mission control center from a movie that you might have seen about a space mission and plant it in these regional towns on our way to these launches and tests and take kids and the whole community through it and show them what this technology is like and hopefully inspire the next generation of rocket scientists and engineers to come in from the outback and develop careers in this really exciting industry.
The thing to recognise is this is an actual working space facility. You're actually going to have kids sitting in the same seats that are used to launch rockets.
Shall we go inside and have a look?
So over the whole facility, between the two, there's actually 54 screens. So we've got 30 operator stations, but then you have overhead screens to show whole of operation missions and what's going on so people can rapidly see what's going on at a glance. In these stations, they also have access to voice loops. So if you're monitoring a launch, and this may have been, you know, typically at NASA or SpaceX or so on, you are listening in to multiple different conversations at once and sometimes speaking on multiple different conversations. So it's really very much a human story about how you actually make these things happen.
So it's a mock-up on the screens at the moment, but this is the sorts of things people might be monitoring. We've got, you know, flight plans, range safety, weather conditions, video feeds. Is there anything surprising that a team eventually might be monitoring in here that people wouldn't expect to see?
Yeah, I think the surprising thing might be we've probably made this look a little bit more flashy than it actually is. There's actually, when you're talking about mission control services, there's something called abnormal situation management. And that's a principle behind that if anything is exciting, you want it to have colours and be flashing. So if there's something going wrong, you need to be highlighting and going what's on. The rest of it should all just be grey and dull. Now, we've separated from that a little bit because we obviously want people to get excited about what they see. So there's lots of colour and lots of flashing things and so on in here. But yeah, ideally...
But some of that's for decoration.
Oh, yes. Yeah, right. You know, there is an inspiration piece here. And you pointed out about the livery outside.
Yeah, there's beautiful, colourful space pictures on the outside of the truck.
We want people to stop and look when this goes by and actually ask, well, what is that? And, you know, why is space important to Australia? And I think there's lots of great stories that can be told about that.
Away from the exhibits, researchers are deep in conversation about everything from rockets and spaceflight to sustainability and space debris to how we use satellite data down here on the planet. One of those is a former ABC Top 5 scientist, Dr. Rowan Fisher, visiting from the top end.
Yes, I'm part of a team of people based out of Charles Darwin University that support fire management across the whole of Northern Australia, in actual fact, across 80% of Australia.
Put it on a map for us.
So it's pretty much everywhere, which isn't New South Wales, Victoria, Tasmania, southern South Australia and southern Western Australia. So, yeah.
Everywhere else.
Everywhere else, the 80% of Australia. And we have been providing satellite-derived fire information, both to provide information about current fires, but also over the last 22 years, we've also built this incredible archive of burnt area mapping, so showing the fire regimes over very long periods of time. And it's assisted Indigenous fire managers to develop new ways of managing fire and has resulted in one of the biggest reductions in fire frequency anywhere in the earth. At the same time, that's led to the development of a carbon abatement program. It's called the Savannah Burning Greenhouse Gas Abatement Program, which is now worth around $100 million a year, primarily led by Indigenous fire managers.
So the team that you're a part of collects the satellite data on where fires are burning and also where they have burned. What happens to the data then? Talk me through how it ends up getting to Indigenous rangers and what they do with it.
There's two primary forms of data that we provide. One is active burnt area mapping. We update that weekly and have done so for the last 20 years. And that forms the baseline to understand the nature of the fire regimes. The other information is active fires. So we've got a suite of satellites that we tap into, which update every 3 to 6 hours and show where active fires are. Now, that's provided through a website called North Australia Fire Information, which has been around for around 22 years. And so we've got generations of land managers, pastoral land managers, parks land managers, importantly, these Indigenous ranger groups. One of the first things they do during the dry season, the most active time of year, is they get up in the morning and they have a look on NAFI, North Australia Fire Information, to look at where the active fires are. They spend weeks and weeks and thousands of hours both on the ground and through helicopters doing what we call early dry season coal burning, and those are the burns which pull up those late dry season fires. They reduce their intensity and their extent, and that's where they get the great outcomes. So it produces healthy country, and those Indigenous groups are really doing a lot of the heavy lifting for greenhouse gas abatement for the rest of Australia. And I must say, you know, I do the satellite work, but the hard work is that work on the ground. You know, it can be 45 degrees up on that country, and they will, with leaf blowers and rakes, they'll fly out there and they'll pull up those fires in incredibly tough conditions. So I'm just in awe of the work of those groups and what they've achieved. They've reduced the amount of fire over an area of around 640,000 square kilometres. I argue that this is probably the most significant human ecological achievement in the world over the last couple of decades, led by remote Northern Australian land managers with the use of space technology.
As well as government agencies and research institutions, there are lots of non-government organisations represented here as well. One of them, a small global non-profit called the Karman Project, named after the Karman Line, which designates the edge of space, chose this Congress to launch something quite ambitious, a Peace Prize for Space. Its managing director, Hannah Ashford, hails from Brisbane.
So we just last night at the Sydney Opera House launched the first Space Peace Prize. The future of space has many risks associated with it. We rely on space technologies for so many critical elements of life. And at the moment, due to the amount of activity in space, an increase of militarization in space, and indeed the sort of fragmentation of the broad geopolitical landscape, a lot of those technologies are at risk. So the idea of the Space Peace Prize is to recognize, accelerate, and indeed incentivize the projects that we need to be seeing in this next era of space. We have an incredible number of precedents being set in, say, even this next 10 years. A lot of firsts are going to be happening. And to us as an international community, how we set those precedents matters.
You mentioned that the space technology that we all rely on without even thinking about it is at risk. What's it at risk from? What's the contrast to peace? Because it isn't necessarily outright space war, right?
In space, what peace means is protecting the long-term sustainability of the space environment. At the moment, we have more satellites and assets and objects going into space than we've ever had before. So there's a really urgent need to ensure that we can better coordinate a space traffic management system. We need to understand as well how different countries perceive risks associated with maneuvers in space. So sometimes a satellite, for example, they will make a particular maneuver to perhaps avoid a collision, but some states may perceive that in a threatening way. So the safety and coordination of the space environment opens up a whole realm of security concerns. But indeed now what we are seeing at an international level is some more concern around the ability for member states or countries to take out another country's enabling satellites. Instead of ground warfare, you're talking about taking down, you know, satellites that serve critical Earth observation technology, communication technologies. You can take down banking systems, hospital systems. You can interfere with aviation and maritime. So there's a whole host of ways in which perhaps a rogue actor could interfere with another country's asset in space. It's on the backdrop as well of the fact that at the moment, a lot of the objects and satellites in space are owned and controlled by private actors, so commercial entities and corporate actors.
And some of them are defense companies, right? Weapons manufacturers.
A lot of them are indeed. So, and it's quite interesting because if you look at the international space community, the commercial market isn't fully developed. So what that means is that most of the companies in space, their number one objective is to sort of serve civilian purposes. However, until we have more of a market in space, they sustain their businesses through defense contracts. So, for example, surveillance capabilities are what we call in space dual-use capabilities.
So you launched your prize during the Congress, but you haven't awarded it yet. What will it look like and when will it happen?
So what's really important to us is to ensure that we have a very robust application and selection process, and that's not something that can happen overnight. So we're going through this design process in the next 4 months, and the aim is to open applications within the first half of next year, together with nominations. We hope that we're going to have visibility into a whole heap of brilliant projects across the world, you know, scientific, technical, diplomatic, cultural endeavours that are well placed for this next era of responsibility in space, and that we can give visibility to those through a shortlisting process. And then the aim is that, you know, in 1 year from now, we'll bestow the first Space Peace Prize upon one project. And really then our idea is that we'll see a ripple effect there. And it's important to me to ensure that this is not just a one-off award where we all turn up and clap our hands and then we leave. We want to make sure that it's actually really a catalyzing factor to give these projects the support they need and also send a signal to the international community that the space sector is taking our responsibility seriously and also ensure that those projects are very well supported in a real way.
You mentioned that there were times with everything that's going on in the world in the past year where you faltered and almost even gave up on the idea of starting a Space Peace Prize in 2025. What made you want to stop and what kept you going?
What we came to the realization of, you know, throughout this process was the fact that right now is arguably the worst time to be launching a peace-based initiative. But for that very reason, it's also the best time to take this step. So we had to question a number of different competing factors. So, for example, how do we engage broadly and ensure that we are keeping the door open to every nation on Earth to be a part of this, whilst also not being politically naive and respecting the fact that in this political climate, it is very difficult to bring particular nations together. And indeed, there's a safety aspect of that as well. We don't ever want any of our community members to feel unsafe. One thing that's important to us is that people do not represent their governments or their states. Our idea is to ensure that even in the absence of political will, if there are people or organizations who can take tangible steps forward, that is a good thing, not only for space, but for humanity.
Also in attendance at the International Astronautical Congress are, of course, astronauts. They're kept pretty busy between meetings and talks and public appearances, but I managed to sit down with Canadian former astronaut and former Governor General Julie Payette. I asked if the Congress had left her feeling optimistic about human spaceflight.
We are a species that is curious, and we are always pushing the boundary of whatever the frontier of the known world is, and currently the frontier is in space. So that will continue. How it will continue, how much international collaboration, who's going to be prevalent and where, that changes all the time, and it's a continuing conversation. But Congress, like IAC, bring people from all over the world, networking, making ties, making deals, talking to each other, and I think it's very important.
And is part of a Congress like this about trying to foster a cooperative atmosphere rather than one that's based on rivalry and conflict, with so many different nations trying to make the most of orbit, but also then explore further?
Clearly there's national pride in some of these things, but you see it even on with the astronaut that we're here. We come from different countries. We all work together. We are actually part of an association called the Association of Space Explorers. And currently, I happen to be the president of this association. It regroups all the astronauts and cosmonauts of the entire world. And there is no discrimination. The only criteria to be part of the association is to have done one orbit of the planet in a spacecraft.
And that could be with a commercial provider, could have been on the ISS. They're all welcome.
Absolutely. Actually, one of the sessions that we had with astronauts at the Congress was a celebration of 25 years of continuous human presence in space on board the International Space Station. And for this, I actually wrote an email, because nowadays we can write emails to our colleagues on station, to get a statement from the ISS commander, who is cosmonaut Sergei Ryshikov. And he sent one in the middle of the night in Sydney, and I got it, and I was able to read a statement, and I'd be happy to give it to you. And we heard many times the importance of working together, its tangible benefits, and that it makes us go further and better.
Julie Payette did give me that statement, and it is indeed lofty in tone, especially in contrast to the statement made by the Russian embassy, who complained about Russian delegates not being granted visas to attend the Congress. But here are the words of cosmonaut Ryshikov celebrating 25 continuous years of humans in orbit.
Dear colleagues and friends, I warmly welcome all participants of the Space Congress from the International Space Station, which for a quarter of a century has united not only us, the crews of space expeditions, but also our countries and continents. In these challenging times, our continued collaboration serves as a ray of hope for many that peace, kindness, reason, and love will prevail. We are all united by the desire to fly and work in space. On October 4, we remember the launch of the first artificial satellite. In April 12, the flight of the first man, Yuri Gagarin. In July, the first landing on the moon by Armstrong and Aldrin. On July 17 of this year, the entire crew celebrated the 50th anniversary of the docking of the Soviet and American spacecraft Soyuz and Apollo. I wish you interesting meetings, pleasant memories, and new plans.
A And the message is signed ISS Expedition 73 Commander, Roscosmos Cosmonaut Sergei Ryzhikov.
Jonathan Webb at the Sydney Convention Centre. Jonathan is the ABC's Editor of Science. Production by David Fisher. I'm Robin Williams.